Thank you so much, Sarah. I got an opportunity to read Human Star. I'm excited to read Cement, and listening to you read and reading your work made me think of something a good friend of mine, the great poet Douglas Kearney, said recently, which is, you know, as writers, we can't write for the people we love. We can only write to them. And I think that that's what I think about in your work. Thank you so much. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for picking this little book. You know, it's funny, like the great thing about being a poet with no self-esteem is that if you win something, it's a huge surprise. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you never expect it. So, and this one, you know, this book came out in 2017, and I just got the news like 6 months ago. And so it was like a double surprise, you know? So I really appreciate it. I really do mean that. I'm not the type of poet, and you'll see why. I'm not the type of poet who wins awards. And I don't say that as a person, like, to feel sorry for myself. When I start reading, you'll understand why I say that. People who usually choose these things don't choose poets like me, and that's fine. Actually, that's kind of a point of pride of mine. But I do think, obviously, this means a lot to me. You've heard Sarah, and that she picked this means a lot to me. And any recognition I get means a lot to me, so thank you. And thank you to the Poetry Center. Thank you all for coming. I know it's like raining and stuff, and that's probably a big deal. You know, I come from Minnesota, where it's like, we're almost like, if it actually snows hard, there's something in Minnesotans that we are just so contrary. We're like, oh, it snowed 18 inches. I'm going out anyway. You know, like, it's just who we are. And I know that that's not quite, you know, what it's like in the Bay. You know, I had lunch with one of my good friends who's not from here, but he lives in Oakland now, and he was joking around, and he was like, I can't come to your poetry reading. It's raining. It's raining. I can't go. So those of you who are here, though, I appreciate it.
It's been raining.
For real. Yeah, it's not even really raining, but whatever. I'm just going to read some poems. I'm going to read some stuff from Thousand Star Hotel. I'm going to read some new stuff. Let's just get to it. Thank you, really. So I was born right before my family had to flee from the war. So I was 6 months old. And you have to understand, when we came to Minneapolis, Southeast Asian families like mine, refugees, were the first large group of Asians to come to the Midwest. And so, you know, there were some Asian people there before, but not like big groups where white people looked and were like, oh, that might be trouble. You know what I mean? Like, we were the first big groups, and a lot of people saw us through the lens of war, and still do. But back then, that also meant that my parents' generation would like rent a VFW or like some building, and they would do cultural events where they would do like poetry and music and food and that type of thing. And of course, you know, like, babysitter is not a word that exists in like Southeast Asian languages. And so, you know, you, like, as a kid, you would just go with them because that's what you did, right? And they would drink like Hennessy and do poetry or whatever. But also sometimes, right? Yeah, see, you know. But sometimes those of us who are kids would like get in a group and walk out of the place together and like play games or just like, you know, mess around. We would also look for video games. Back then, video games you had to put a quarter into. It was in a cabinet, and you had to put a quarter into the cabinet.
Yeah.
And you got three lives. That's how old I am. That's, you know. So this is about one of those times. It's called Refugees from Prom Center. Who says Asians can't dance? Have you ever seen old Vietnamese people, cha-cha and tango, like their feet and hips asked to be colonized? I walk away from them with kids older and taller, blocks away, the promise of video games in some arcade or maybe the front of a store. I hate Vietnamese people, one of the boys says suddenly, scowl like a blue marbled switchblade. I hate my own people, he says. to make sure we get it. I've only got one quarter, so I hold it in my palm and watch the other kids play, including the hater, who puts his quarter into a slot and does his best to control his one man out of three. I can't remember what game he played or whether I cared that he hated Vietnamese people like me, like him. Nah, that's a lie. I knew I didn't care. I was rooting for him, even after I saw him lose life after life. This next one, so that's about internalized racism. This next one is just about good old racism. So my mom, you know, she still lives in the same house that she raised me in. We were raised in Minneapolis' largest, poorest, and most racially diverse neighborhood. I don't know if Minneapolis made the national news last year because there was a homeless heroin, like a Native American homeless heroin encampment. That's my parents' neighborhood. That's where I was raised. And my mom has always had a green thumb. Like, you go to a garden, it's like a Hayao Miyazaki film and shit. It's like butterflies and lights, you know. And she used to take me to go buy plants that she could plant as a little boy, because again, you know, and this is about an argument she got into at a craft store with the cashier. The lines are long, and my mom insists that the final amount is wrong. The cashier looks at the receipt and insists that it's right. My mom purses her lips, looks worried, says, "It's not right." The line of white people behind us groans. My mom won't look back at them. We both know what they're thinking. Small woman with no knowledge of the way things are in America, though year after year she makes flowers bloom in the hood. Petals in the face of this land that doesn't want her here. Finally, a manager comes, checks the receipt, checks our items, and informs the cashier she rang up 22 plants instead of the two that we were trying to buy, overcharging us by $40. My mother holds my hand, leads me away without looking back at the line of white people who overhear and gasp. Their sympathy won. If only I was old enough to tell them to keep it. It's not my mom's English that's broken. You know, part of being a poet is like coming up with these clapbacks. I wish I had when I was 11 and shit. All right, so I'm a dad now. And you know, coming from a poor family, coming from a poor refugee family, you have a kid, sometimes you overcompensate, you know? You're like, I never went to Disney, so you're going. I don't give a shit if you want to go or not. We're going to Disney World. And you know, my daughter's totally down. She's like, yeah, I like shit. You know, I like stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, we sometimes have these very real discussions about money and stuff. And, you know, we go visit her grandparents and, you know, she knows, so she knows where I come from and where she comes from. You want to hear a funny story?
Yeah.
Oh, no, wait. That's a part of a poem I'm going to read later. Shit, never mind. But it's about that. So basically, so just kind of keep in mind that my daughter likes stuff, like any kid, she likes stuff, but she also knows that her dad came from a certain way. And yeah, here we go. This is called Lights. A small handle with fiber optic cables springing like snakes from Medusa's head. Press a button and tiny colored dots at the end of the translucent strings would light. The day after the Shrine Circus, all the kids in my class had one, waving them. My dad asked me if he'd ever broken a promise, and I said nothing. He never took me to the circus because he didn't have the money, not because he couldn't keep a promise. How do you say that to your father? Almost 30 years later, my daughter and I go to the circus, first time for both of us. She holds my hand, but wants to run past the bouncy castles, the face painting, the pony rides, all things she loves, all things that cost money. Sitting alone in our seats waiting, I ask her why she doesn't want to be where everyone else is. because I don't know if you can afford it, she whispers, then leans her head into my chest, and I'm glad she can't see my face. Later, after the Orientals have been introduced and Pretzel thrown themselves into the thick air, the circus runners turn out the lights. Over the loudspeaker, some asshole will tell all the kids to lift their glowing butterfly wands, lightsabers, laser pistols into the air and wave them proudly, show them off, and tell us over and over if we really want one, we can buy them from the men holding enormous bags lumbering up and down the aisles like mercenary Santas. The light-up things pulse, illuminating my daughter's face in hyphens of light as she stares across a sea of bright things, 1,000 blinking promises never asked for, 1,000 flashing neon signs telling her what she doesn't have. I'm going to read one more poem from here, and then I'm going to move to new weird stuff. I come from a poor family, but I've been terrified of insects for a very long time. And for a while, I was living in this basement apartment, which had, the good thing about them is they had floor-to-ceiling built-in bookcases, right? Which is like fucking heaven for a book nerd, right? But the bad thing about it, it was a basement apartment, and so it had a bunch of these house centipedes all the time, right? And I did a bunch of research back then to get over my fear of them. Didn't work. But I found out all these things about them. You know, they're beneficial, they eat worse insects. A lot of people mistakenly call them silverfish. They're not silverfish. Silverfish are a completely different insect. So I wrote this poem, not a silverfish. A large centipede was in my tub for days. It looked like a prehistoric zipper made of needles. A firecracker with too many fuses. I skipped taking a shower for way too long. An unspoken compromise, hoping it would disappear on its own, preferring to be dirty over drowning my fear. Eventually, I trapped it under a container, took it outside while it scrambled like an explosion of exclamation points under the foggy plastic, and let it go. These centipedes are often mistaken for silverfish. They actually make dinner of them and other more damaging pests. I know what it's like to be mistaken for something else. To feel that the first reaction when a new set of eyes encounters your body is to want to smash you. To wonder what in history made a caterpillar, a ladybug. To know what it's like to be invisible until revealed to be ugly, alien thing, hairy wiggle, whose body tells the only story anyone is willing to hear. When it shook free of my trap, its head made of stepladders, its body a spasm of 100 loose threads of fate, it didn't make a sound, but I swear I could hear it scream that it wanted to travel to prehistory and rewrite the many veins of possibility that would shape how it'd be seen so that the present could be a place where it could be understood for what it really was. So I'm going to try to read three new things. Let's see how your endurance is. Anybody watch American football in here? No? Some of you, though.
I'm at odds with myself.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm a Vikings fan, so I understand exactly what you're talking about. This is called Gun Buffalo, Right Key, Left Seven Heaven. And so the new stuff, I should tell you, I've been kind of stuck because I've been writing, and I'm like, oh, what am I writing? Am I writing poetry? Am I writing fiction? Am I writing nonfiction? Getting like all hung up on it. And I'm trying to get back to that place that's like, just fucking write and like sort it all out later. Gun Buffalo, Right Key, Left Seven Heaven. Anyone who believes women are overly emotional and irrational have never met a straight American male football fan. I can't speak for women, obviously, but demanding equal pay for equal work and an end to rape culture is far more rational than, say, hoping the Vikings win a Super Bowl. There are homophobes who closely study and are almost erotically charged by the balletic footwork and hand placement of 300-pound offensive linemen. Poets who cheer star athletes who have abused their children and partners. plumbers and bankers who swear they are not political, yet wear jerseys bearing racist mascots. Before you turn your nose up, understand the sport is not a bunch of meatheads knocking each other down, at least not any more than any other arena or social activity of any sort involving straight men. Football involves real-life physics, such as wind speed, velocity, geometry, the angles of attack and defense, all in real time and at the speed and power of human beings who represent the top 1% physical specimens of Americans. Think of the game of football as chess, with 22 human pieces all up and moving at once, half of them trying to kill you while your brain processes their patterns, feints, movements, and then you must physically execute within split seconds and windows of inches. We are no more unreasonable than, say, a Star Wars nerd who thinks there were too many women and non-white people in the last movie, or video game nerds who claim that racial representation is no big deal, yet freaked out when Dante's hair went from white to black. By the way, I'm both also a Star Wars nerd and a video game geek, so that's why I can say that. Bill Belichick, a coach who can see things no one else can see in football but apparently can't see anything outside of football, is widely reviled because he is dour and uncharismatic. Sean Payton, the great coach of the New Orleans Saints, is a truly repulsive, shit-stained, shitbag, poop-ass, fuckhead, shit-stain of a human being, who somehow manages to be well-liked. And if we study this here, we understand the power of narrative. Patrick Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers are artists, poets in motion, making something out of collapse. Tom Brady is a surgeon. His whole existence is this one job. He is utterly boring, unless you're the one on the table needing surgery. Each game is a mural that reveals us. There's a picture of Stephen Gilmore covering Odell Beckham Jr. chest to chest, so close they appear to be slow dancing. Colin Kaepernick, kneeling down, was what made white people take away his superhero cloak. But we made him immortal. Marcus Mariota, the pride of Hawaii, was often criticized for being too nice and therefore not manly enough to lead a football team. Seriously. It was through the becoming a Vikings fan that I learned what it is to love something unconditionally. The practice of non-attachment towards the Vikings is the closest I've ever gotten to my mother's Buddhism. It's 2017. 8 seconds left in the game. The Saints are up by one. The aforementioned piece of shit bag coach, Sean Payton, is trolling all of Minnesota by mocking our skull chant on the sidelines with his smug shit-ass face turned to the crowd. Case Keenum, a journeyman washed-out quarterback cut from multiple teams, forced into starting after an injury to our starting quarterback, playing arguably the most difficult position in all of sports, runs back away from the maligned offensive line that is supposed to protect him, and he throws the ball. In the locker room, when all of this is over, he will turn to a reporter and ask in disbelief, how are you going to write about this? A typical NFL game will have close to 200 possible offensive plays that take into account every possible move of the 22 players on both sides of the ball on a field at a given moment, each with different move sets, strengths, weaknesses. They are coded so that the other team cannot understand what is being shouted into the air. This particular play that I'm writing about is named Gun Buffalo Right Key Left Seven Heaven. Buffalo, B for Buffalo, means bunch formation. Three receivers align close to disguise the play. F in the word Buffalo is the point of attack. Key left is where the offensive line will attempt to block the wave of men on the other side attempting to attack the quarterback. The high seven is the root farthest out, the player who runs the fastest and the farthest, intended as a decoy. In practice, the high seven never, ever gets thrown the ball. In this very real game, with 8 seconds left, they run the play with Stephon Diggs as the high seven. The ball snaps. With about 4 seconds to think while the other side is rushing to pummel him, Keenum must look at his three teammates streaking down and across the field to see if they get covered by the opposition. Rushing right at him is Saints defensive end Cameron Jordan, 6'4", 287 pounds, who has been clocked running 40 yards in 4.6 seconds, and who after the game said he was one half a step away from blocking the pass. As well as Sheldon Rankin, 6'2", 305 pounds, whose scouting report claimed he plays with powerful, violent hands. Keenum throws the ball to Diggs, a player who got into trouble for fighting in college over captains on opposing teams refusing to shake hands, picked 146 in the fifth round of the draft, criticized by NFL scouts for playing smaller than his size. He lost his father to heart failure in high school. His mother is an Amtrak train attendant. He leaps, a gazelle in midair, or perhaps more accurately, a goddess. His white gloves outstretched in prayer and catches the ball. He has already taken a snapshot of the field and the position of every opposing player between him and the goal line in his head as he leaves the ground. 4 seconds left. The Saints' Marcus Williams dives at his legs in what they call a kill shot, trying to clip Diggs underneath, a borderline dirty play that has a high risk of injury if he actually hits Diggs. We're talking about the Saints here. He misses. Christian players on the Vikings will later say this is because of God. Some Minnesota fans will later Photoshop Prince into it. The musical genius and Vikings fan who died a year prior, claiming his ghost was the one responsible. One way or another, Diggs comes down with the ball. But if his knees hit the ground, the play is over, and so is the game. He puts one hand down to earth, stopping himself inches from falling to the ground. Spins and has roughly 3 seconds to run 34 yards. He crosses the line exactly as the clock hits 00 to win the game. Minnesota fans are used to our team being on the opposite side of bullshit like this. Before the play, analytics had Vikings at a 2.6 chance of winning. A lifelong Minnesota Vikings fan once wrote, "I included in my dad's 2014 obituary, he would have liked the Minnesota Vikings to be his pallbearers so they could let him down one last time." But on this evening, thousands in the arena and millions more on television are screaming and crying as if the Wicked Witch has finally been slain. Vikings fans across the country who have Apple Watches get an alert from their devices notifying that they may be having a heart attack. This is all nonfiction, literally. Stephon Diggs is weeping, but he covers his face with his jersey, and when he pulls it down again, he's made his face into a stoic mask. But several other times, as the cameras are lingering on him, he breaks down again, crying, and every single time, he pulls his jersey back up until he can regain control, pulls it down into a stone mask, even as a wave of humanity pours love on him so strong and so loud it may knock him down. Look, no one likes an armchair quarterback, but in that moment, I wanted him to keep crying and pull his hands away and just let all of us see. Thanks. In a survey conducted by the Asian American Man Study that asked, "Who is the Asian American man you most admire and why?" the person with the second most votes was Bruce Lee. The most votes went to, "I don't know, can't think of one." Back in 2001, when some of us Asian American poets were able to visit Bruce and Brandon Lee's graves to show respect, Jason, you were there, right? Yeah, you remember. It was Tayo who said this. "Being associated with Bruce probably kept us from getting our asses kicked. Because even though it was racist, bullies assumed that all Asian kids knew karate or kung fu. and that reduced the number of ass whippings. It's different now. Some people think that martial arts that Asians practice is all for show and it's fake. No one's scared of Asian people. I haven't seen Tarantino's latest. I've heard that a stuntman fantasizes about fighting Bruce Lee to a draw, that Bruce is a caricature who brags about killing Muhammad Ali, when in real life Bruce Lee admired Ali greatly. I don't know if Tarantino deliberately made Bruce seem racist against a black man to take the heat off of himself for using the N-word so much. That might be giving Tarantino too much credit. I did see Hateful Eight, a movie that seemed to suggest that men, regardless of their race, could come together by hating women. The performances were stellar. He knows how to coach terrific performances out of people. Camera work is beautiful. Setting as tight as is the dialogue. The writing and the story of it has absolutely no redeeming qualities whatsoever. There is nothing there. Nothing. Even Tarantino stands can't seem to say a thing about what the movie is about. A negative stereotype about Asians. We're good technically, you know, like we're good at technically doing stuff. We're good at skillfully copying other people, but we have no soul. We have no soul in what we do. And yet, that's exactly who Tarantino is. And he's one of the most celebrated filmmakers of his generation. By the way, did you know that Tobey Maguire's stunt double in Spider-Man 2 was a Vietnamese guy? That Andrew Garfield's stuntman in the other Spider-Man movies was Korean? They make a lot of Spider-Man movies. That the martial arts stunt double for Oberyn Martell in his fight against the Mountain in Game of Thrones was Liang Yang. Also the bad guy that Tom Cruise and Henry Cavill fought in the most recent Mission Impossible movie. That some of the Asian men that Keanu Reeves himself, a mixed race person and apparently a real sweetheart in real life, fills with knives, bullets, and punches in John Wick 3 are accomplished martial artists from films such as The Matrix and The Raid. That the main bad guy, Mark Dacascos, was Brandon Lee's body double and sparring partner on The Crow, who filled in for a lot of the shots when Brandon was killed on set. Do you know how much hard work it is for these bad guys to flip and throw themselves in the air to exaggerate the power of a hit from one of the good guys on camera? How hard they work to make all the people hitting them look good? Count the number of Asian names credited as animators, programmers, and designers in movies and video games. Now count the number of Asian faces in those same entertainments. Asians have been your heroes. We're just not allowed to show our faces, unless we're the bad guys, of course. But then again, the boy at the center of the Balloon Boy hoax was Asian, though he's so young that you can probably blame his white father, a failed actor and comedian, for that. What is less clear is who to blame for his older siblings' mixed-race Asian-American son's pro-Trump heavy metal band. C-RAC released a study recently, an excerpt of which stated that many Asian-American boys and men are seen neither as men nor as men of color, what they call a double invisibility, but what I prefer to call a complete invisibility. My therapist told me recently that studies show being ignored has longer negative effects than even bullying, because bullying means you get attention. A man riding a bike at top speeds in San Francisco, running through several lights, strikes a 71-year-old Chinese-American man, killing him. The bike rider posted a eulogy to the death of his damaged helmet. He swears he was out of his mind on painkillers and thought the man would survive. He received probation and community service and has now created a podcast declaring that it was he who was the victim. During Linsanity, I spoke with some of my close friends who are Asian American men. We knew what was going to come, even when the things were good. The hate, the dismissal, the putting into place. We should have known that many of the loudest voices trashing him, and therefore us, would be from other Asian men. Because the quickest way into acceptance for marginalized people in any Western culture or arena is hating and dismantling your own. And the fact that Asians are considered neither men nor people of color makes us a particularly easy target. Leftists, who I generally agree with politically, do this too. They only bring up Asian men when we're being problematic. I mean, Asian men should be criticized. Just because we're marginalized does not make us automatically pristine. But I do notice a tendency where we don't register in people's consciousness unless we're being problematic. Look, I don't want to vote for Andrew Yang due to some blind nationalism, nor do I really want to speak out against him to prove my wokeness. I don't want to have to look like Harry Golding to be noticed, but honestly, sometimes I prefer not to be noticed by any of you at all. I don't want to be measured by anyone, no matter what their politics are, based on my opinion of crazy rich Asians. I remember being both bullied and ignored, which tells me that people only saw my race when it was a reason to punch me. Invisibility versus hate, and that's not even a choice. It's rather simply the lenses by which the majority of the world sees us. I once saw a behind-the-scenes footage from one of the Matrix films. Colin Chiu plays Seraph, a role meant for Michelle Yeoh, who turned it down due to scheduling conflicts, and also turned down by Jet Li, who did not want his martial arts moves to be copyrighted and owned by Warner Brothers. So Chiu is sparring on a set, meant to invoke a dim gray garage, and with this otherworldly grace, he swings his leg in this beautiful kick, but he accidentally hits the other stunt person, just a little bit. Without breaking his kick or his stride, he finishes the arc of this graceful kick, spins around, and wraps his arms around the other stuntman in a close hug, as if in an apology. Okay, here we go. This is my last writing thing. Whatever it is I'm writing these days. Thank you all for your patience and thanks for coming. Thanks again, Sarah. And thanks for everyone involved in bringing me here. I know that stuff like this takes a lot of effort and work behind the scenes that often doesn't get acknowledged, so thank you. Yeah. I'm not just saying that. It's because it's my job to do that back in Minnesota. This is called Treat Yourself. When my daughter is being a dickhead to me, I buy myself a treat. I spend money on myself, which is less money I have to buy her Harry Potter Legos and shit. It's how I punish both of us, you see. Her for being bad, me for being a bad parent. When I was a kid and I was bad, I would get yelled at, then ignored. See, Midwesterners give cold shoulders, and Vietnamese people fit right in because we have fucking glaciers for shoulders. I mean, like, fucking Titanic sinkers. I take that back. As a Vietnamese person, I shouldn't be putting out such inaccurate stereotypes. See, Vietnamese people will cut you before they give you the cold shoulder. Anyway, there was no retreating to screens back then, just hiding under the table or a blanket until at least one of my parents' dispositions got sunnier, which was not often. It's not really fair to say I had it harder than my daughter, because of course I did. Just like my parents had it harder than I did. You know, the whole war refugees coming to a land full of xenophobic racism and all that. Back then, it was fine for them to say that they had it harder than us constantly, and they sure did. I remember my mom asking me to stand by myself in the grocery line with items and some cash, because every coupon had an item limit. And this way we could double up on every coupon. It's fine. It didn't scar me. Standing in a supermarket gaming the coupon system was the least of my fucking worries. I often say we didn't have money for stuff like toys, which is mostly true, but not like as 100% true as I lead my daughter to believe. I did have one or two G.I. Joes, two or three He-Mans, like two Transformers. There were also board games, missing pieces, and broke toys at the secondhand stores. Things were hard, but my parents did fine. I'm not gonna beat up on my parents and my writing, because this lifetime and this culture beats them up enough. When my daughter was 4, I stopped in the middle of Mall of America and got down on one knee in front of my daughter to take a moment to teach her to be grateful for what we have. I admit, there was some theatrical considerations. Not for the strangers all around us, but for the cinema I hope she would play back in her head when she grew up. This is what happened. This is a true story. Song, I want you to appreciate what you have. Not everyone gets to have toys. Why? Well, like my parents, when I was little, they couldn't really afford toys. Why? Well, a lot of reasons, but part of it is they were raising six kids. Me and your mom are just trying to raise you, so it's a little easier for us. Yeah. You don't take care of all of your kids, Daddy, just one. No! That's not what I meant. That's why I get to have toys. Never ever try to plan out cool shit that will play out in your child's mind. It will backfire on you. It took me 40 years, but I worked and lucked my way from moving every time they raised the rent to having a mortgage I'd lose sleep over. The other day, my kid, 10 years old, asked if the recession was still coming and whether I was going to lose my job. I told her the truth. Maybe, you never know. She said, "Don't worry, Dad. If you lose your job, I'll always have Mom to take care of me." She asked me for a new water bottle because the straw on hers is all gunky. Then she changed her mind and said maybe we can get a replacement straw, save some money. I wanted to buy her everything in that moment. I settled on a set of watercolor brush markers, which pleased her. She painted several cats and said she liked the markers because they're like watercolor paint, but marker. See, she's a genius. She once suggested that fancy houses have chandeliers and she would like to live in a fancy house, or at least a house with bigger rooms than mine. When we moved in, I hired an electrician to put a small plastic chandelier in her room. Even though I was scared I could lose my job any day, or my health and this condo and all of that, anytime, any day, any moment, he tried but couldn't. He said, in order to put up this plastic chandelier, I'd have to tear the whole ceiling down. Then what would you do? Thank you, everybody.